This episode of the FitCast is brought to you by the PTAdvantage.com, an online resource to help trainers save time and make more money. It is hands down the best resource I've found for distance coaching. You can check them out at the PTAdvantage.com. Hello, welcome back to the FitCast. This is episode number 284. I'm Kevin Larrabee, and along with me for this episode, I am back on the show for a follow-up, Dr. Jonathan Fast. John, how you doing?
What's up, man? How's it going?
Good. It seems like we just did this 2 weeks ago because we did.
Ba-dum-bum.
Yeah, and great. So we do have some new questions, and we got some follow-ups to the stuff that you talked about last time. There's going to be zero FMS talk. That is not going to come up at all. So that will be good for everyone, and we're going to really get right into it. But before we do, a couple quick announcements. I get to pre-record a bunch of stuff before I go to Japan next week. So I'm going to be first. I can at least announce that Dan John's going to be on the show tomorrow. So hopefully, I'm going to get this episode. And look, I've been putting out episodes like every 5 days. For the FitCast. So we've been going pretty hard, but we want to get this out so we can get questions for Dan John. Also, I got emails out to, I know Ben Bruno has been requested to be on the show, so our people have had requests for Ben to be on the show, so I'm finally going to get Ben on, and there's two other emails that are out that I'm waiting to hear back from, but hopefully we're going to record three episodes this week. So if you can keep an eye out on twitter.com/KevinLarrabee or same thing, facebook.com/KevinLarrabee, or if you're signed up for our newsletter, I'll send out stuff through there so you can make sure you get some questions in for these guests. And I will balance them out. One of those is a female. So hopefully we'll have a at least a little bit of a balance as we go forward. Also, quick thing that I wanted to mention, teespring.com/backinmyplay. I am trying to raise, first I'm trying to get some shirts made for my other podcast, and two, we're trying to raise some money for the Boston Children's Hospital. And if we do get these shirts funded, they're $17 a piece. If we sell 50 of them, we'll be able to generate about $350 to $370. They give you kind of like a guesstimate of how much money you'll get out of it. All those proceeds are going to go to the Boston Children's Hospital. So if you like games or you want to support children, that's a great way to do it. It's teespring.com/backinmyplay. And then finally, before we get into it, a heads up, we don't really get a ton of money for advertising for the show. You know, we've had some advertisers in the past, but and we talked about this in the past, but if you guys like the show and you want to support it and make sure it keeps kind of going strong, donations are a great way to do it. And it is kind of like one of those things where it does take up time to do the podcast. It takes time to get the people lined up. It takes time to edit it. It costs money to host it. It costs money or time to keep the website going and stuff like that to make sure it doesn't crash.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I know this for a fact now. I mean, it does. It takes a lot of money and a lot of time. And it's just I think what you're saying, I mean, it's free content in a sense. And it's stuff that I think that everyone, including myself, it has been influential in people's careers and people, the way that people approach exercise and the way, therefore, that they better themselves. So really, to me, the question kind of is, I mean, like, we do this stuff for free. We're not looking for payment, but at the same time, it's like, what is the value of the FitCast to you, the listener? You know, and if it has a value and you want to help to make sure that it continues, it's almost like PBS, right? You know, it's like PBS is a nonprofit, but it still needs money to function. And for sure, man, these podcasts are actually not that cheap to kind of run and produce. And so I can vouch for Kevin on that one.
Well, again, you know, it's just a time and money thing kind of going forward. And I love doing the show. Obviously, we've done almost 300 episodes of
amazing.
It. And it's coming up on its 7-year anniversary in April.
That's crazy. That's crazy.
No, that is nuts. Like I didn't think this would get to 100, let alone almost 300. Yeah. And
I remember you putting together the show. back in the day on like JP Fitness forums, crazy. You know, talking about it. Yeah, man.
As like crazy. A 19-year-old. So the cool thing with all this stuff is that, like I said, when I look at organizing the things that I want to do in my life, the things that I kind of talked about with Brian St. Pierre last time, I really enjoy doing stuff like this, but we kind of have to make it make sense for me to do the, you know, spend the time to do it. Like, where do I budget my time throughout the week? And I really have come to the conclusion that I love doing this stuff and I love interviewing people. So if you guys, like John said, if you've enjoyed the podcast over the last 7 years, you know, don't, like, if you can afford it, you know, if you could donate some money at thefitcast.com, there's a little donation tab on the right hand side for PayPal. You can use PayPal, credit, or credit card, any of that stuff. You know, I would appreciate it. Like, again, it means a lot. Whenever I get like an email, if it's like $5 from PayPal and someone says, you know, Jonathan Fast donated $5, every time I send an email, I say, man, thank you. Like, that's awesome. Like, to take the time and to take the money to donate to the show, you know, it really does mean a lot. Like, it's some of the letters that I've gotten in those donations, like people can put messages, like, put me to tears. Like, It's just great to see that stuff. So, you know, again, that's how you can do it. And also thefitcast.com/donation, I believe, is another link too. But just go to thefitcast.com. There's a big tab on the right-hand side. Anyways, so John, let's talk about some stuff.
Yeah, man.
So we got a bunch of questions added on to this. And I'm trying to put a couple questions into one big question. But we are getting towards the beach season as we go forward. Are. And, you know, being an evidence-based man, that's how you lead your life.
I
apologize out there. I'm going to try do my best to kind of bring all these questions into one. When it comes to programming for fat loss, what's been your favorite approach? What's the approach that you kind of go for with working with clients and, you know, kind of go with that mindset?
You know, it seems to still be the sort of conversation that we have in fitness, and you've got one side of the argument saying basically exercise does very little towards ultimate fat loss and focus more on the diet. And I think the other side says, well, it's a little bit more important than that. I don't want to paraphrase what that argument is, but I think people do think that it makes a big deal or a bit of, or enough of a difference that it's important. And I tend not to feel that way. And when you look at the research, it's kind of shows that interventions, you know, interventional research where they'll take like, they'll look at weight loss results between group A and group B, and they did, you know, one did aerobics, one did strength training or whatever. You see very little over long periods of time. So maybe that the groups lost like 4 pounds or 6 pounds over like 6 months or something. That's a great achievement if you've never lost weight before, but it's to kind of put it in functional terms, if I was a personal trainer and you hired me to lose weight and you'd lost 6 pounds in 6 months, you probably would have fired me. So, and that's 6 pounds of like fat loss. We're not talking about this idea of like, well, they didn't measure for muscle gain. They did. So in my opinion, the research, I think, points very strongly to the idea that how you program is probably less important than that overall calorie consumption, what you're putting in versus what you're putting out. Exercise shapes that. So from my perspective, I think it's more valuable to look at what your goals are. And for most people, I think it's fair to say that we probably want some amount of muscle. We don't want to just lose weight. We'd like to look pretty good when we do. So I focus on strength training pretty consistently. And I'm not too interested in like doing, you know, circuit training or this or that or whatever. To me, that's less valuable, assuming that the client is following a good nutritional program and they've got a good deficit in place. If they don't, then I will rely more on exercise, knowing that it's not going to do as well, but you kind of have to work with what you've got. So if you've got someone that really isn't adhering to the diet well or can't for some reason, then yes, you want to try to create more of a caloric deficit, and you can do that through specific programming. You can try to encourage NEAT, non-exercise activity thermogenesis, so the stuff you do during the day. Like, you don't want someone working out for an hour but then sitting for the rest of the day. You want them to try to be active throughout the day. That's your best bet, and you're going to have to recognize that your The response that you get from that will be limited. I can say that pretty confidently, both through experience, but also very much so by what the evidence is suggesting happens. So it's not so much about what you do. Do what you enjoy. Do the type of exercise and activity that you enjoy. Do lots of it. Do lots of different things. You know, just enjoy the fact that you're moving and you have activity. It's good for many reasons. Don't just focus specifically on the weight loss. And in fact, I find that's a pretty bad idea for a lot of people, because when you limit your focus to one or two simple outcomes, if those outcomes are compromised, you stop realizing how much good you're doing just by the fact of activity. Mm-hmm. So just enjoy and embrace movement, being healthy, being active, being strong, being, you know, mobile, whatever it is that you want to do, go climb a tree. Don't just lift a weight, you know, but let the weight loss come from your nutrition.
Yeah. And I think you brought up a couple great points there. You know, one, just make sure you're not just in the weight room doing your exercising, you know, make sure you do stuff outside, go for a hike, you know, do something that is going to be stimulating to you besides, you know, strength and conditioning. Like, you could literally lift twice a week and go for like two hikes and be in great shape.
And you know what's really throw a side point. We were talking a little bit in the off topic about, I just got off of a ski trip, and what I realized was this ski trip, I was in the worst shape that I've ever been for one of our ski trips, because I really, you know, I just had a honeymoon a month ago, and I've really been inconsistent in the gym since, because I've just been busy as all hell, difficult to get back into the, you know, the swing. So I have a workout here, then I miss a week, then another workout, and I...
Okay, the internet connection in the Middle East has been resecured. They connected the pipes below the sea again. So... John, you're talking about, you know, getting back into the swing of things and stuff like that.
Yeah, and I was just adding the idea that I'd just been on a ski trip, but I've been really inconsistent in the gym since my honeymoon, because there was just a lot going on. And I just, while I was skiing, I recognized the fact that I was not as good as I've been in years past, not necessarily skill-wise, but just my ability to ski continuously, because I was getting more tired, I was getting more sore. You know, it was an activity that I wasn't used to. And in the past, because I was in shape and stronger, maybe I was able to do these things and not feel that impact. But this time, because I've been inconsistent in the gym, it wasn't quite as enjoyable. So just realize that when you're exercising, you get to exercise, and you should enjoy that and embrace that and be grateful that you're able to do these things. And it really does literally help you to enjoy life. So don't narrow it down to the idea of, oh, it's going to help me lose weight. That's great. It's great if it does. But, you know, focus just on the fact that you're exercising and that's healthy for you. And if your interest is weight loss, then allow your nutrition to help you along to do that, and focus on the exercise to shape what you're able to do and ultimately the way that you look.
Yeah. And, you know, as you kind of go forward, make sure you're lifting heavy stuff. That is going to be the best way to make sure you maintain that muscle mass. And
yeah.
Don't go with, you know, sets of 20. Don't do any of that crazy stuff. Remember that, like, the high.
Or exclusively.
Yeah, like only three sets of 12, man. Only three sets of 12. That's a joke. So, cool. Next question that we got from Chris. I've decided to try CrossFit. I've lifted with a bodybuilding powerlifting focus since high school, mostly after college, and I'm 32 now. I want to try something different and meet other fitness folks. Any thoughts of things to keep an eye out for, especially around minimizing injury risk? And John, before you jump in, I got some crap about this like a month and a half ago when we talked about, or I talked about it on the show. Okay. But let me just reemphasize the kind of main issue, and we'll talk about this, that I still have kind of with CrossFit, is that you see people that, let's just take a step back. Let's talk about athletics. Most injuries occur as an athlete fatigues through competition. Okay, it doesn't happen in the first quarter. It happens in the fourth quarter usually.
Right.
At least some statistics that we have show that it's more common. Let's put it that way.
Right.
So
it absolutely is.
Kind of the main focus that I of kind of my disagreement or reason why I don't like CrossFit is a lot of people who, and Chris is well-trained, like he's in good shape, but for people that aren't well-trained, or even if you are, as you fatigue throughout the work, like you're still doing like hand cleans, you're doing snatches and things like that. You're doing step-ups, you're doing box jumps, you're doing kipping pull-ups. As you fatigue, your risk of injury escalates exponentially. So that is kind of my big thing of why, if everyone ever asked me, should I try CrossFit, I would say probably not, unless you find a really good gym and you pace yourself and you don't get bullied into going harder and faster than you should be going. Because I think that's kind of what happens in these atmospheres when it's a competition. People get pushed so hard, you run into, the next day my knee feels terrible. Or, I woke up today and guess what? I can't bring my arm past parallel to the ground. And these become a problem. So I just wanted to clarify that, discussion that I had a couple weeks ago before I toss it off to you. So what do you think for Chris?
It's a really good question because it's quite the hot topic as of late, especially because of that horrific injury place at the games recently, where the athlete dropped the bar on his neck, I think, and got paralyzed. We did an episode on this a little bit ago on the strength of evidence with the queen of fitness journalism, Jen Sinclair, as our guest. And we looked at what the evidence is, and it's very, very, very limited. But it's a great question because this has been the prevailing thought. Oh, it looks really good. People appear to get strong. They're probably getting into great shape, but at what cost? Is there an increased risk of injury? Right now, we can't really say. There was one study that did report on injuries, but almost as an afterthought, and you can't take too much from it. We don't know why those injuries occurred or what happened, and if it's something that we could extrapolate and say, well, this is applicable to all CrossFit, or maybe it was just that specific gym. On the other hand, the dog's about to bark. Sandy, come here, please. Good girl. Thank you, honey. She's quite the guard dog. And here she goes again. Sand. Thank you, honey. So, pardon me. There's been new research since we did that episode. There was one looking at the Army, and they were looking at armed forces and how they respond to CrossFit training. And it actually found that their injury rates were similar to general injury rates for the armed forces, for armed forces training. But that's also a group that's dealing with a lot of activity. So that's really not something that we can extrapolate from the armed forces and use as evidence for or against the average individual going to a CrossFit box. So the too long didn't read version of that is we don't really know if CrossFit is more injurious than other forms of activity. We can only speculate, and speculation makes it difficult to actually, get an idea of what it is.
You can always pause for a second, John, if you need to.
There's a dog outside. That's what's going on.
Oh, a puppy Sandy? Outside. Ooh.
Yeah. Sandy, sweetheart. Sandy, we need to be quiet.
Welcome to the Pet Cast.
Yeah, really.
Weekly, dog
She's
and cat.
Usually so good.
No, it's
usually so good.
Sandy, well, we'll pause for a second. We'll be right back. You won't even notice we're gone.
Oh, my God. I am sorry. The dog is sitting next to me right now, and she's being very quiet.
Great. So continue on. You're talking about new research with CrossFit.
Yeah. So the research really doesn't tell us anything. So the only thing that we can probably do at that standpoint, I agree completely with what you were saying, although I don't know if fatigue exponentially increases risk, but I'll give you that one. We do know that fatigue is a factor in producing injury. So if we keep that in mind, we're really looking for a CrossFit gym that respects that idea. Fatigue is an aspect of exercise, but how you manage that fatigue is probably a very important factor. So are they respecting that? Are they guiding you? And are they making sure that they're on top of you and not allowing you to go past a point that you should be going? Or like you said, are they pushing? And is it this kind of every day is a competition atmosphere? And that can be a bad thing. So, we want to push ourselves, but it is it absolutely necessary to push yourself beyond a limit and consistently do that? There's no evidence for that whatsoever. And when you weigh the potential for possibly getting injured or having a pain experience because you're just doing too much too often, that's something significant that you should consider. So when you evaluate a CrossFit, you should probably do that as you would anything, which is, do I believe that this is a safe environment for me to be active and to be athletic? Or are there things that I'm seeing here, sloppiness in form, pushing people past, you know, fatigue points and things like that? If that's occurring, you should probably stay away.
Very good. Hopefully we answered that for you. Next question. When you're looking for new fitness and new knowledge in fitness and nutrition, what are your go-to sources? How do you determine who to trust?
The number one thing to me, and the thing that guides not only a source like a blog or something, but any source of information, is bias. The idea that whatever the information you're receiving has been influenced in some way by the source itself. So for instance, if I, you know, maybe I'm a blogger and I have this thing about, you know, pain science. My bias is coming from that belief, that investigation into that area of knowledge. That's not a good or bad thing. It's just a fact that when I talk about, let's say, injuries, I'm probably going to bring it in to the idea of pain science as well. And maybe in certain subjects or certain topics, I'm kind of overemphasizing something and underemphasizing something else because I'm more interested in pain science than I am, let's say, biomechanics or something, because I think it's only one aspect of the pain science that's not as important. You know, that can happen, absolutely. So the idea is, when you evaluate your source, you have to know what their bias is. What's their education? What's their background? What's their history? What are the things that they believe? And then you investigate those things. So if you felt that my bias was pain science, but you did an investigation, hopefully you would find that it's a fairly well-established field of information. And you might be a little bit more confident in the things that I'm saying might have some validity. On the other hand, if I'm, you know, a guru that's developed my own specific kind of exercise or field, you know, or workout program, like a CrossFit, right? Do we think that, what's his name, Glassman, and this is no disrespect to him, but clearly his bias is that he believes CrossFit is the best way to exercise, right? So if I'm getting advice from someone on how should I exercise, if I go to him, he's probably going to tell me CrossFit, right? And he could be correct, but I should probably know that. Otherwise, because if I think he is not biased and that he's weighing out all things equally, then I assume that that's the right answer because it's the right answer, not because he thinks it is, if that makes sense. So when you evaluate a source, do your research on the things that they're talking about. Do your research on any information that you think might be valuable to the way that you practice or maybe just the way that you exercise. So if I say that a certain exercise is the best way to, you know, enhance your pectoral development, well, find out if that's actually true. And if it is, you might have more reason to believe this person later on, at least in this specific area. If you find out that it's not true, or maybe I'm kind of glossing over the subject a little bit and I'm cherry picking and pulling out certain things that correspond with that belief, but I'm ignoring others, then that's not a great source of reliability. Ultimately, I think that blogs are an important part of educating yourself, but they should be a relatively minor part. They should be something that might pique your interest in a new area or a topic that's not really something that you work through but might tangentially be important to you, right? So for me, I might like a blog that has to do with nutrition because I'm not a nutritionist, but it's certainly an aspect of how I operate. So maybe those things are important to me. So maybe a blog is a good source for that. But as far as physical therapy goes, I want to actually read the research and I want to go to conference and I want to get information that might be more, less biased through research itself and that's more directly influential in what I do on a day-to-day practice. So choose your bloggers, know their background, see that they are in fact experts in the thing that you want to learn about, and then randomly check on them. Make sure that they're being honest. And if they're doing that and you're doing that regularly, then you can probably be a little bit more confident in the things that they're saying.
Can you talk about, and this is actually a good kind of follow-up to the question about fat loss and things like that and programming. Do you have any unique body weight exercise that you have had to use with limited equipment in Saudi Arabia? You know, being a case of, you know, sometimes it's fun to kind of change it up with some body weight, you know, circuits to challenge yourself. Have you kind of messed around with any cool body weight exercises?
Yeah, well, actually, I think this is also a good follow-up to the CrossFit stuff, because they do a lot of that body weight kind of exercise.
The burpees and all, you know, the burpees.
And box jumps and these sort of things. And I've been doing a lot of that lately. And I think I've spoken about that before, because I don't have a squat rack here at the gym, you know, so it sort of limits what you're able to do in one respect, but then you're doing a lot of single leg work. You're doing a lot of lifts from the floor. But you're also doing stuff like L sits that, that I actually had a little blurb in, menshealth.com about, and different ways to do push-ups, like push-ups with the feet against the wall and handstand push-ups and things of that nature. And there are flags and lever arms, front levers and things like that for the back and pulling strength. And I do enjoy that a lot, because I feel that it's not only an exercise to develop strength, obviously, but it's a skill. It is a skill, and it's a skill just in the same way that deadlifting is, but from a different perspective. And it requires different abilities and allows you to explore different ways of physicality. And I think that's great. So I'm kind of glad in some ways that I have some limitations in the way that I work out here, because it has forced me to kind of look at more like playground workouts. You know, these kind of crazy YouTube videos where you see these guys doing like nutso stuff on a playground. Because all they have is their own body weight, and they do some fantastic stuff. So if you are interested in these sort of things, YouTube is a great resource for that. And just put in, like, you know, playground workouts or gymnastics workouts, and there are incredible, incredible exercises that you can challenge yourself with, and they are really difficult. You know, doing a planche is incredibly difficult, and it's basically a plank without your feet on the floor. It's nuts. You know, I think I've held one for like 10 millionths of a second. You know, I mean, it's really hard. So stuff like that can absolutely reinvigorate a routine that may be getting stale otherwise. And I do like to use those things with some of my clients too at certain times, just for, you know, a little bit of exploration into what they can do and to make something, you know, maybe a little more exciting than just the standard prescription of squats and deadlifts and, you know, bench press and pull-ups or whatever. So it's a lot of fun.
Very cool. Let's go to the next question. I'd like to hear Jonathan's opinions on knee rehab, patellar tendinosis for power athletes, and what the best strategies are, and specifically why they are good. Also, what to strengthen stretch, SMR, why you should do it. I find the advice you get from physios somewhat random and haphazard, and often more applicable to non-athletes.
All right. Yeah, both are good questions. About patellar tendonitis, tendinosis, it's a little bit of a junk term a bit. It's kind of like just, oh, I have knee pain. The evidence points to the strengthening of the quad. And the activation of the quad. So in clinic, we'd be using electrotherapy to strengthen the quad if we find that there is a lack of activation. And there are clinical methods to do this that are reliable. It's not just saying like, oh, you're weak. You know, there's actual ways to investigate how the quad is performing. It's called superimposed burst testing. But that's a very specific piece of equipment, and very few clinics would actually have it. I had access to it at the University of Delaware when I was a resident there, so I became quite familiar with it. But essentially, that is what you're doing. You're looking to strengthen the quad, and you're probably looking secondarily to look the mechanics of it, change the inputs. We don't know exactly what's happening at the knee. There could be some tissue inflammation. There could there may not be inflammation. And we don't really have any way of understanding that unless you actually went to have some type of biopsy done anyway. So there may be some mechanical or physiological factors being involved. The term overuse is also a junk term, because we don't know what that's referring to. Is it an overuse and tearing of tissue or strain to tissue? Or is it an overuse from a psychological standpoint of overactivity, which is considered to be a threat that could lead to this type of tissue degradation? So we're not exactly sure why it's occurring, and we certainly don't know in any individual. So the methodology of finding issues through your systematic evaluation is still going to be the most important thing. You know, do I find that they have their knee pain after they run, or is it after they squat, or is it when they take stairs, or when they get up out of a chair or sit down in a chair, things like this? These sorts of findings can help you to determine what is your best strategy to helping this individual. And there may be a couple of things like, you know, stretching and strengthening or whatever, but these are just general things that you do to increase movement, to provide activity that is safe and does not provoke pain. And if you do that and you work within the scope of what you're able to do, so you've got soft tissue and you've got stretching and you've got strengthening and you've got just general movement and activity, even thinking that you're strengthening as the answer to the problem presumes that the problem was weakness, and you're not even sure of that necessarily. So you really just have to become a detective. There's no one size fits all, but there are, you know, like those general areas of how are they moving. If it's a squat pattern, how are they squatting? Can you fix something? Can you change the way that they're moving to possibly reduce the inputs at the knee the one way, and to improve input, proprioceptive input, sensation, nervous system involvement in another way? And that usually solves the problem.
Very good. Okay, the next question that we have, man, I'm sorry, I didn't write down names for a bunch of these. you know who you are. You got your question answered. What effective means, I guess this is a follow-up from last time, what effective means are there for evidence-based practitioners, personal trainers, physical therapists, sports doctors, and nutritionists to quash pseudoscience on a social media platform level and on a personal level with family, friends, and clients, and to direct individuals toward the right direction of, quote, thinking? How do you get people to believe what you believe, John?
Right. Well, chances are you actually have to appeal to both logic and emotion. It's not, and I think that many of us, including myself probably, forget that. And we think, well, if I just throw a bunch of studies their way, they'll just see that this is the right answer. And we make decisions in a combination of many things, many issues. And emotions are a very strong part of that. Emotions, experience, history, beliefs, preconceived, pre-held beliefs, all of these things come into play. So I think probably the real answer here is to understand who you're talking to. And if you seek to understand them and their beliefs, then you probably have a better opportunity to change those beliefs if you think that those beliefs aren't true. I posted a quote that I got from Ben Goldacre, but it turns out that it's probably a requote from, I think, Jonathan Swift. But the quote is, "You cannot reason people out of a position that they did not reason themselves into." And I think that's really, really good and really informative. If you decided that, the sky is green, right? And I tell you to look up and see that the sky is blue. If you decided that sky was green because emotionally you want it to be, then me showing you evidence to the contrary only reinforces your beliefs that either I've got it wrong or that you're the only one that sees the correctness of your decision. You know what I mean? You can't reason someone from an unreasonable standpoint. Now, if they're seeking knowledge and they're open to it, then by all means, say, here's the evidence, this is the evidence, this is the evidence. But someone that wants to believe, we can take either sides of the political spectrum too. We have people that deny global climate change, that has an extraordinary, extraordinary amount of evidence behind. And we also have people on the opposite side of the spectrum that deny the safety of GMOs, which also has an extraordinary amount of evidence to suggest that they're safe for consumption. Both of these positions are highly evidenced positions. To take the contrary isn't just because maybe someone doesn't know that the evidence is there. They're denying the evidence. They're saying, no, 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 but. And that's a very difficult position to argue someone out of. When you, you know, or maybe vaccinations, the safety of vaccines and no connection to childhood autism, right? That there is an enormous, enormous, enormous world of information that points out to the fact that this is not the case, including the fact that the original scientist that pointed that to that connection was fraudulent. So yet I've had these arguments with people all day long, and they're just not going to vaccinate their children. And you're not going to be able to reason this individual because they have an emotional belief. So if we speak to that person on that level, acknowledge their concern for their children or why they come to this belief, and we can possibly help them to understand that their emotional beliefs are not reflective of our knowledge and what is truly better for the child, maybe we have a chance. But it's a difficult position. And I think that on social media, and I've had people tell me this before, that the effect is not necessarily on the person that you're arguing, but everyone else that might be receiving the information that you're providing within that argument. And I think that that's probably true. A lot of people come into these kind of discussions about, because we've had these discussions on Facebook of all places, you know, is it worthwhile arguing? I'd even taken a step back from arguing. I was just arguing everything for a while there, and I was just like out on in full force, you know, the trying to do good. And I decided that I was just getting nasty. I mean, it was just like every day I was looking for a new argument, and I just didn't want to do that. And surprisingly to me, I had a lot of people not supportive of that decision because they said how much that they received, you know, an information and thought process and thinking when they saw an argument take place. And I think that that's probably valid, and I think that that's probably true. So although we want to try to change the opinion of the person that we're talking to, we also have an obligation to the people that may be reading along with us, and therefore trying to affect every possible point and basis for their confirmation and for their belief is probably the best way that we can go. But in the beginning of the day, I got to be honest with you, if I enter into a debate with someone, my assumption is I'm not changing their mind, because it's a tough thing, and there's an entire world of social psychology that explains why our beliefs are what they are, and changing them can be a very difficult thing.
Very good. I think we are kind of wrapping up on the home stretch here. Why are you so angry at gurus?
Great question.
That's
right?
A question that we actually got.
Yeah, we did. You know what? The reason why I really have a strong distaste for gurus, and I think that's just because it's a spread of misinformation.
Yeah,
we have enough questions in our fields. I'll give an example of I had a very strong reaction from someone once because I was asked the question, "What does the transversus abdominis do in preventing lower back pain?" And the evidence suggests that it does next to nothing. We have no evidence to suggest that strengthening transversus abdominis specifically does anything to affect our back pain in the best research that we have available to us. It doesn't mean that activity doesn't help, and it doesn't mean that just being, you know, strength training and exercise and all these things don't have a value, but we don't know that it prevents, and we can't say that what helps to reduce pain will therefore help to prevent that. Biggest misconception that people have. They figure, well, I did this, you know, I did something in physical therapy because I had pain once, so if I keep doing it, I won't have that pain. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily the case. So I had this huge argument with this guru who was, you know, he was citing evidence. It was evidence from like Janda from like 30 years ago that has been essentially disproven, that's been shown to have what's called falsification data, which means if I put forward an idea, the opposite of that idea would disprove it. So in other words, if I believe that strengthening my transversus abdominis will prevent back pain, possible falsification data would be someone, a group of people doing exactly that and then having back pain episodes that are no different than a group that did not, right? That's falsification data because my idea was not able to predict a reduction of injury. And he just refused. He refused. And to me, I think the reason why he refused is it just so happens that he has videos and educational materials on strengthening transversus abdominis for prevention of low back pain. And he gives talks about this in seminars. So he makes money from this. Clearly, he has a vested interest in this idea being correct. And therefore, he's going to argue the hell out of it. Now, if I'm just Joe Trainer trying to find the best way to go about my business and to help my clients, I might take this up and say, oh, I've got to do this. And this goes back to what we were talking about last time I was on, the idea of pain research. By emphasizing transversus abdominis, by emphasizing a muscle and activity as being either good or bad. If I stand a certain way, it's bad and I'll have back pain. If I move a certain way, it's bad and I'll have back pain. If something is weak, you are weak and therefore you will have back pain. I may actually produce the very thing that I think I'm protecting against. So to me, gurus not only misinform or mislead, they may actually do harm. And I think that it is a moral obligation. Certainly, I took an oath as a physical therapist to do no harm. And therefore, I believe it's a moral obligation that we are aware of the evidence and that we do our best to satisfy what the evidence tells us to do, to take it into account. Because that evidence is showing us information that can help our patients or, in the least, will not harm them to the best of our knowledge, to the best of our ability. So to ignore that fact to me is immoral. And therefore, in many ways, I think gurus are immoral.
All right. That's a positive way to end the episode. So that is going to be it for this edition. Again, if you guys are kind of getting home or you're walking the dog and starting to get towards a computer, that donation page is readily available. Again, any help would be greatly appreciated. Also, coming up on the show, we're going to have Dan John for next episode. And we have an off topic that is talking about travel and stuff like that. If you want to hear about, where'd you go? Aspen? Switzerland?
No, it was in Switzerland, dude. Whatever. That's another country.
Yeah. Aspen. It's a Dumb and Dumber reference. So you can hear about that and going to Japan and all that stuff. So if you'd like to, stick around for that. Otherwise, hopefully you will come back for 285 where we talk to Dan John. So have a great rest of the week. Welcome to, since we're doing another kind of retro episode, we're doing an off-topic segment with Jonathan Fass.
Right?
Right.
It's like back in the play.
Back in my play.com.
Yeah, I know, but it wouldn't have made sense if I said my.
Man, it's kind of interesting. Like, we have 2,000 listeners, and we have quite a few people that follow me on Twitter and Facebook, and I could only sell 5 t-shirts to raise money for kids.
That's some crap.
How gross is that, man? So I'm going to talk about that in the start of the show, too, because I might as well, the FitCast audience is pretty dope. So I'm hoping they can. And these are, they're good looking shirts and they're high quality shirts. Like, I didn't want to get the cheap, like, Hanes crap shirts.
Right. Good looking host, good looking shirt.
Yeah. Double dribble. So what have you been up to? You've been digesting any, I'm guessing we're not going to talk about House of Cards, but can you get Netflix out there?
I can't actually. I cannot. It does not stream overseas. Bummer. The only thing I can get is iTunes.
Oh, I don't know if it's on there, but yeah, hopefully when you're back in the States, you can digest that in like 24 hours.
I heard it's really good.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It's nuts. Makes you like think about the government a little bit more.
Because that's what I want.
Well, it's about the government. Well, I always think it's fun, like shows like The West Wing, which, you know, isn't obviously super accurate to how things go, but, you know, just like all the, like, it's basically all just wheeling and dealing in the government. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's like, I'll help you if you can help me with this other thing. It's so gross.
Right.
But anyways, not to get political. So yeah, man, I leave for Japan in a week from today.
Sweet.
Yeah.
I guess got back from Switzerland.
Awesome. How was that?
It was fun. It was good. It was plenty the ski trip. Plenty of snow, man. It snowed like half the time we were there. And when you ski in snow, and it's not like I'm some type of expert skier or not, but it is, it's awesome and also difficult because you're like, it's literally you go snow blind. Like, it's very difficult to see where you're going because the world is like just white and snow. It's kind of crazy.
Were there any snipers in the mountains? Like,
yeah, it was crazy, man. Like, I was, you know, so I'm skiing down the mountain with my machine gun, obviously, right? And they're like,
so it's like Total Recall. It's like True Lies. That scene in True Lies.
Yeah, True Lies. Yeah,
skiing backwards while shooting.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Or Jackie Chan's First Strike. Yeah. I think it was.
Oh, it was cool though because like my instructor was having me do all kinds of crazy crap. Like, I'm like jumping and skiing on one leg and like crazy stuff. I was like, yeah, which like to anyone that actually skis, they're all laughing right now because like, yeah, whatever. But it was crazy for me. So
nuts. That's cool, man. So I'm gonna, now that you did your trip, I'm gonna be doing 2 whole solid, rock solid weeks in Japan.
Nice.
And while I'm out there, I'm actually gonna be doing like a 1-day seminar, so it's kind of even work related, but it's going to be so weird. I'm trying to prepare myself so I have zero need to come back home. Because the last 2 trips, like the last trip, I was supposed to stay out there for 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. I stayed out there for 12 days. because I'm like, man, I kind of need to be back home for this work stuff.
Right.
And there's only so much you can do from a laptop with a 14-hour time difference. So I'm getting like, this is what we're doing right now. Like, I'm pre-recording a bunch of stuff, and I'm getting a bunch of stuff done for Body Bubble Online and all this other stuff to make sure we are 100% good to go, so I can kind of just go out there and basically do all my work minus my coaching and my clients, but spend it in Japan. And I haven't worked on my Japanese at all.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah. I mean, whatever.
It's an easy language. You should pick it up.
Well, it's not even that it's an easy language. I've been kind of like addicted to books recently on Audible and stuff like that. So it's a trade-off, and I'm going to be staying with people that know can help translate stuff for me if I really need to, but otherwise I can get around. Have you been out there?
No, I have not. I've been to Asia, but not Japan specifically.
You got
to
get the prince to go out there.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure they have a 4 Seasons in Tokyo.
They may very well. They definitely have something there that he owns. I mean, he co-owns like like 5 different brands of hotels. So,
well, maybe you should
definitely something.
You should go out there for your next trip and like ask for a couple. Can you get like a discount on a hotel room?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah,
sometimes it depends if they know the manager. They're usually like, they'll just, the travel department just emails them like, yo, can you hook this guy up? And they'll be like, yeah, sure. Sometimes, and other times we'll get like a specific hotel will give a discount to like members. See, because the difference is, even though I work for the guy that owns the brand, I don't technically work for the brand. Yeah. So things like friends and family discounts aren't necessarily something that I can get.
Gotcha.
Because I've had people be like, oh, we want to go on vacation. Can you get us a discount? I'm like, I wish I could. I can't, you know, but they will do favors for us. So it would be possible. You know, I don't know if it's definite, but it would be possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an oddly calming place for me.
That's cool. Well, it's like,
especially outside of the
Zen meditation. So
yeah, and it's so bad that I got like this game plan right now. Like, I already told the people that I'm staying with, all right, I land there. I fly out 24th. You basically land on the 25th in the afternoon.
Right, right.
And, man, and it's, oh, God.
It is.
It's a 14 and a half hour flight. And
that's, dude, that is not bad. To get to Mauritius for our honeymoon from Ireland was 12 hours. And that was brutal. I honestly would have thought you were looking at like a 16 hour flight.
Well, it's good with these 17. new Dreamliners. They're so light that they can go a little bit faster and they can have less gas in them. So they get there pretty easily. I'm just hoping we've had some really bad weather up in Boston lately. I'm just hoping to get out and get to Japan, and it's going to be, man, it's so weird. Like a couple weeks ago, I wasn't even thinking about it, and I was almost like, man, I'm not even really like pumped about going, but now that it's a week out, I'm just kind of jazzed.
Yeah, no, of course. You know, it's funny because I get the same way though. Like, I don't get excited until I'm sitting in the airport and I'm about to get on the plane, and then I get excited. But everything leading up to it, I'm just like, well, we'll see.
Yeah, and it's kind of like weird. I don't really have plans for when I get out there. I land on the 25th. I said the 26th, we're going to Akihabara to try to get all my game shopping done in one day, and get some kind of bad food at the curry place, and then try to just kind of like relax and kind of just go with the flow after that. Because it's just kind of weird just to be out there and to be surrounded by all this stuff that makes kind of no sense.
What kind of stuff?
Well, I mean, it's obviously the signage. When you get far, like an hour outside of Tokyo, there's very little in English. Just the way everyone goes in a day-to-day in their pace and things like that is completely different. The amazing... the kind of the just how the people are incredibly nice and patient and don't, at least for the most part.
So it's a culture shock.
Yeah, I mean, it's a culture shock, but this is my fifth time there.
Yeah, but it still doesn't matter. Dude, honestly, I think that it honestly took me 6-7 months to get used to most things here. I mean, it you can go out there and sort of know what to expect, but until it becomes second nature, like it's kind of funny. Like right now, we're waiting on Marianne's visa so she can come and join me here, and she has to have a visa. You can't enter the country without one, and there's no like visitor visa, so she has to come as my wife, you know, to live with me in Saudi Arabia. And we were actually hoping that she would be here this weekend. And that I literally just got a message from Human Resources Department saying they're still working on it. Jeez. It's a visa. We've been married for a month. What is taking so long? And the answer is, it's how things are done here.
Yeah.
You know, and so for us, this is unacceptable. You're told a time, a length of time, it takes this long, whatever. And then half the time it's done sooner than, you know, you were told. And here it's like, oh, it'll be ready in 2 weeks. And it's been like over a month now. So I'm used to it, and although it frustrates me, I'm pretty much, you know, I was saying, well, hopefully we'll be here in the middle of February. For Marianne, even though she, you know, she knows what it's like around here, it's not like we don't speak about my day-to-day, this is killing her. But that's a culture shock. That's something that you're not used to, but I've been here for 4 years, so I'm like, yeah, okay, no surprise. And you just sigh and you move on. So it really takes a while to get used to small details. And as you're getting used to certain things, other things pop out that you weren't prepared for. And it's all of that. And it makes travel exciting, but also difficult when you go to a new place, because things are just done differently. You know, it's neither good nor bad necessarily, but it's just differently. And it takes a while, man.
No, it's a good point. I'm going to try to do a much better job, like documenting, you know, the trip with more video and, and pictures and things like that. And
sure.
It's just a thing that I almost didn't even think of. Like last trip, I barely took any pictures just because like, I've been here before, but I think it's some interesting stuff to share. And the food out there is just everywhere you go, it's fantastic. Like there's just, if you go out there, you'll be amazed. Like how are these people, how do they stay as, you know, how are they not all obese?
Right. You know, I mean, honestly, like to me, and that's why I have taken to photography. And I mean, it draws me back to when I was actually an artist as a kid and in high school. I mean, I originally, when I was in high school, I thought I was going to be an artist for a career, but I'm not, you know, some type of great photographer, but I do enjoy it. And the more that we travel, the more that I enjoy it, because exactly that, it's not just for your memories, but it's for the opportunity for other people that will never get to see Japan to see it through your eyes, through your lens.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's something that's really cool, and it's really nice to share. If you're not on my Facebook, please friend request me. And, you know, if you want to see like pictures of half the world, it's awesome. I mean, it's really fun. I look back at those pictures and I'm really, you know, glad that I took them. So for sure, just always have a camera. Just take everything, man. You can go through it later and delete things, but you can never take a picture that you didn't click.
Yeah, good call. All right, so I think that's where we're going to wrap it up. We're going to go record a show.
Yay.